This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Welcome back. It's the second hour of the show. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Jack Brighton, Brian Wagner at the controls. A quick mention of tomorrow in the first hour, Marianne Fugate will be here. She's home economics educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. We'll be doing a household hints kind of program. She does have an awful lot of practical information at her fingertips dealing with the problems around the house. She's been here before on the show many times, and we always get lots of calls. So that'll be hour number one. Hour two, we'll be talking about how memory works. And there our guest will be Daniel Schachter. He chairs the psychology department at Harvard University and is the author of the book, The Seven Sins of Memory, How the Mind Forgets and Remembers. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. Always invite your questions and comments and give you the opportunity to call. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with author Douglas Rushkoff. He is the author of a number of books that deal with new media and popular culture, including Siberia, that's spelled C-Y-B-E-R-I-A, Media Virus, Playing the Future, and also a novel, Ecstasy Club. Recently, also, he wrote a book detailing his concerns about how it is that people who want to sell us stuff get us to buy it. The book is titled Coercion, Why We Listen to What They Say. Now, that came out in 1999. He also does radio commentaries for NPR's All Things Considered. He is professor of media culture at New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program. He's also written pieces for many different magazines and newspapers, and just to name a few, Time, Esquire, GQ, and The Guardian. His newest project is something that's being billed as the world's first open source online novel. And if you don't deal with computers and the internet, that may mean nothing to you. If that's the case, hang on and we'll explain it so that you'll know what that means. It's titled Exit Strategy, and it invites people to participate in this, not exactly by changing the text, but by adding to the text. If you're interested in reading it, it's being serialized online at Yahoo Internet Life's website. So several chapters there. They'll keep adding chapters. And so if you can get to the internet, you can go and you can read that for free. The first chapter is also excerpted in Yahoo Internet Life's magazine. They actually have a physical, you know, old-fashioned printed on paper magazine. That's out. And eventually that will be printed on hard copy available in bookstores. So we'll talk about all this morning with Doug Rushkoff. And if you have questions, you can certainly pick up the telephone and give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Mr. Rushkoff, hello.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. Well, first, I want to talk about exit strategy and explain to people the idea and the premise. And the premise of the story is that in the future, a couple of hundred years in the future, a manuscript comes to light which talks about life in what would be our near future.
Right.
2008. So here's the idea that someone writes this, pens this in 2008, it's lost. It's recovered a couple of hundred years in the future. And here now the people of the future are reading this and trying to figure out what exactly it means, because there are all sorts of references in it to things that in the future maybe don't exist anymore or are different. And so it's the idea is that it's like future anthropologists trying to understand our time at the remove of 200 years.
Right. I mean, what was happening was I actually started this book as just a regular novel about really my many friends who were getting sucked into the dot-com world, you know, fooled by, you know, visions of great pyramids of wealth that were about to be theirs if they could just come up with the right fictional business plan and get Goldman Sachs on their side. And as more and more of them went in, and I wanted to write a story about really about the market and the book I call it Market Fascism, this sort of, you know, market extremism, the obsession with money and with the speculative economy at the expense of almost every other pursuit. And as I was writing this book, and it it's really an allegory of the story of Joseph from the Bible, the idea being that people who build pyramids are slaves. You know, Joseph gets sold into slavery and ultimately brings his brothers down when he becomes prime minister, but they all become slaves again. And as I was writing this, I wanted to be able to share with people a picture of a world in which we were no longer suffering from all this. I mean, our characters sort of win at the end, but I wanted people to be able to imagine a world where we were no longer so market fixated. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to paint a picture of that world, it's going to get very utopian, and I'll fall into the problem of just creating another ideology, another ism, whether it's, you know, libertarianism or communism or anarchism. It's just going to be another way of looking at the world. So I thought, rather than painting an exact portrait of this, you know, post-market future, what I would do is sort of send little messages back to us from that future in the form of these footnotes, so that instead of us seeing that future, we would see the way those people look at us. And in doing so, we would be able to experience our own reality from, you know, 200 years of perspective, and maybe have a little laugh at our own little problems.
Yeah.
Kind of like what Jonathan Swift did in Gulliver's Travels, by becoming really small or becoming really big. You know, he could shift his perspective and then comment on his society from, you know, from the feeling of great distance. And then that experience of writing these footnotes for me was so much fun. I realized, you know, I think the real value of this is not just for people to read my footnotes, but for people to get the experience of writing footnotes themselves. Let them put themselves in the mindset of an anthropologist in a fictional future 200 years from now, and then look back at Microsoft, at capitalism, at, you know, even you know, chauvinism and meat eating and condoms and all of the things we have in our society, and think about whether or not they would really be around in 200 years and whether or not readers would even know what those things were.
Yeah.
They would need to have them explained to them.
Just it's sort of to give people an idea here, I have it on my laptop here in front of me. The first line of the first chapter is, I wasn't in it for the money. Honest, I was in it for the game. So, and now here also there are highlighted here on the screen the words money and for the game. And so the idea would be is here, put yourself in the position of this future anthropologist 200 years from now. You're reading this manuscript and you come along the word money. Now, to in, so what you're saying is in the future, the idea of money or what that meant to us would have to be defined, because people might look at it and say, well, what's that? So then what you've done is you have a footnote. You have written one for money, and what it says is, I think this is your, is this one is your footnote.
Blue?
Let me. Yeah, I know, because the yours are in blue, and then the other people's
right,
are
the additional ones they put in black.
I guess no, there isn't one.
This is an added one. I'm online with you right now.
Okay.
Now means a laughable, conflicting, dualistic concept. For example, to be both the source of all evil and to be worshipped as God. So in other words, money in the future is no longer means money. Money is a it's like a slang. You know, it's slang for something.
Mm.
And then someone else is saying, you know, it was the practical cornerstone of human existence until the late 21st century. First developed to assist in the transfer of goods, it developed in many forms. As acquisition of goods was so difficult, the process became the focus of human activity. Money's key role in this process led it in becoming the key to power and control, meaning evil. Having this money was thus thought to be the source of happiness.
Mm. And there's,
I mean, they go on and on.
There's another one that's a little bit more straightforward, and that's what's funny about the footnotes is some of them are fairly straightforward definitions. Like here's one that says money. It's a system of exchange where notes, in parentheses, rectangle pieces of paper, and coins, discs or metal, were used to acquire items. Well, yeah, that is it. But there are others that are either funny that reflect the fact that people in the future actually don't have any clue what this thing really
right.
was.
Someone does say what, you know, money is, okay, rectangular pieces of paper that represent value, also, you know, round pieces of metal, you know, just experiencing money from that perspective, sort of from the Martian anthropologist, as we used to call it in college, you know, what would this look like to a Martian anthropologist? You realize, wow, you know, what is this
mm-hmm.
stuff? You know, and it is fun. It's fun to experience it from that perspective. The other thing that's an awful lot of fun is the stuff that these people are now writing where the anthropologists get it wrong, you know, which is an awful lot of fun. Like a lot of the anthropologists, the anthropologist characters, are you know, horrified by how much meat we eat and our abuse of animals in this culture. So they're sort of, you know, these writers are implying that in the future, you know, we come to like animals and appreciate, you know, that they have souls or whatever. And one of them wrote, they footnoted the phrase gooseneck lamp.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, we can only presume, you know, that people of this age, if they were this cruel to animals, you know, that they would also, you know, make the necks, that make their lamps out of the necks of geese.
And there's another reference to some character wearing a herringbone jacket. And
right.
The people in the future are figuring that it's literal. It means this is a jacket made out of herringbones.
Right. Made out of herringbones, and they're wondering, you know, and then they'll look for evidence about how could these people have actually woven clothing out of the bones of herring, you know, were they mashed and turned into a plastic, or so it's a lot of fun. And apparently, you know, if you look at say from the last century, some of the anthropologists from the early 1900s, the way they looked at the 1800s or 1700s, and now how we found out how very wrong they were, you know, these misinterpretations are probably accurate. You know, that there's no reason to believe that anthropologists 200 years in the future will see us any more accurately or understand, you know, where we're coming from any more than we understand where people in the 1700s are coming from.
Yeah. So that's the idea, that there are footnotes to there's the text, and there are footnotes to the text that you've added. And then the
right.
way that people can participate is by writing their own footnotes. And eventually what's going to happen is you're going to go through all of these, select the ones that you think are best, and then eventually there will be a book. It will be available in book form with
right.
the best of the footnotes that people have contributed.
Right. Well, the original version, which has, I guess, my 200 footnotes, will be available as a print-on-demand book, which means you actually buy it online and they make it to order. And you'll be able to buy that through the website or through, you know, Amazon or one of the online book merchants. But the idea is then in January, once, you know, the entire book has been posted online and everyone's had a couple of months to add footnotes, I'm going to go through and hopefully with the with their help in the online forums, pick the 100 footnotes that have either generated the most controversy and discussion, or the footnotes that kind of developed a new style. In other words, the ones that become regarded as the great classics because they launched, you know, long series of footnote discussions, or some of the footnotes that have generated other footnotes. I like the idea of this thing being like the Talmud, where you have this original text, but that the real the value of it is not the original text, but all of the conversations around it. So I'm interested in comments on comments and so on and so on. You know, there's some footnotes that end up with four or five sub-footnotes as the fictional anthropologists argue about what something really meant or what it means now.
Mm. Well, let me real quick just introduce, in case anybody has tuned in. Since we started talking, we're speaking with Douglas Rushkoff. He's the author of a number of books dealing with new media and popular culture. And this new project here we're talking about is an online novel titled Exit Strategy. And as we have explained, he is inviting people to participate in the process by suggesting their own footnotes. And if you would like to read this, it is being posted sort of chapter by chapter on Yahoo Internet Life's website. So it doesn't cost you anything. You can go there for free, and you can look at it, and you can play along. Also, if you just would like to see what it looks like in a hard copy print, the novel's first chapter is in the Yahoo Internet Life's August issue of their physical magazine. So it should be out there, and you can take a look at it. But again, if you can get on the Internet, you can participate, you can read, and you can be in on the whole project.
Right, they just have to go to you know, Yahoo Internet Life site, and there's a link on that front page there. It's yil.com.
And this
to be confused with Yahoo, you know, originally I think they were associated, but Yahoo Internet Life actually has nothing to do with the Yahoo web server company.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I guess I figured that somehow it was the same name. It was somehow the same.
It's some kind
people.
Of a brand thing, but it's not. It's great. I mean, it's almost like the stuff, the absurd stuff in the book. You know, they're actually physically and business wise, they are not connected anymore. They started out as somehow, you know, part of the same company, but no, Yahoo Internet Life is a Ziff Davis enterprise.
The book, I think it's the book we're talking about, Exit Strategy, has already been published as a book.
It was published
in Britain
as a book, and I hoped for it to be published at the same time right now here in the United States as a book. But when my publishers found out that I wanted to release it online simultaneous with the first print release, they were horrified. You know, they were as horrified as the record industry was in the 1930s when radio stations wanted to play music, you know, copywritten recordings on the radio. You know, the record executives thought it would, you know, it would eliminate their record sales. Of course, by the 1950s and 60s, they were actually paying radio stations to put stuff, to broadcast their songs. But at the time, they thought of it as a threat. And that's really, you know, ironically what happened to me, you know, about a year ago when I kind of announced my plans to do this. I, you know, lost the support of the publishing industry and was forced to really make a decision between, you know, the money and the fun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the sentence you read from the beginning of the book, I decided a long time ago I was in this for the game, not for the cash. So.
Well, and I'm sure that that's a question that a lot of people would ask. They would say, well, you know, to heck with the publisher. Yeah, they're worried about making money. But here you've done the work and now you're giving it away. They would say, in a way, that doesn't make very much sense.
Well, it does, finally. It makes sense from a social perspective. It makes sense from a thematic perspective. In other words, the values I'm trying to promote in this book is that the bottom line is not the bottom line. You know, the bottom line is whether or not we are enriching the experience of ourselves and our fellow human beings, whether we're educating ourselves, creating meaning, creating dimensionality. That's what matters. I mean, I sat at my desk and thought, do I have a roof over my head and food in my mouth? Do I have enough work and stuff that I can pay my rent and keep myself fed until the next book advance or the next article? And yeah, I can. So whether I publish this as a book or online for free is not going to make a difference in my quality of life that matters to me. And releasing it online does make a difference in the quality of living. In other words, not quality of rent or food, but my experience as a writer. And finally, you know, financially, there is something called the gift economy, which is a much more real economy, I think, than the speculative .com economy. The gift economy means, you know, if you go, let's say I go and do, which I do a lot, a free talk at a university about something, some subject that matters to me or matters to them, you know, I'll end up, really thrilling a bunch of the professors there who then might go read my books and then decide, wow, this Rushkoff's really got something. I want to use this book as a textbook in my next lecture class. Then I'll go sell, you know, 500 books. So, you know, in a gift economy, you still end up making money. You still end up selling things. You just understand that sharing what you have for free often really comes back in a virtuous circle to support you in creating more of it.
Mm. And I suppose there still remain out there a few dinosaurs like myself who would actually rather read it as a book on paper.
Read it as a book on paper too. You know, the point of putting it online, really, although yes, people can read the whole book for free, is not really for people to read the whole book for free. It's for people to be able to participate in the writing of the footnotes around the book. I mean, if it were me, I would go ahead, I mean, and this is not an advertisement for the thing, but I would go ahead and buy the paperback print on demand, you know, have that, read that, you know, and make little notes to it, and then use the website to add, you know, to add my footnotes, you know, and then, you know, it's just for fun. What I've done is, you know, the 100 best footnotes, they'll be in the next version of the book that I put out in January, and then I'll, you know, send a copy to everyone who's in it and invite them to a book party and, you know, just see if we can, you know, create a little fun for ourselves that way.
Sure.
But, you know, it's pain. It's a real pain to read a book online, something of that length. That's part of why I've done it as a serialized, you know, weekly thing so that people don't get, I would really hate to think of someone sitting there for 14 hours, you know, reading my entire novel in a single setting on a, you know, laptop computer. This, the damage I would cause their system would be terrible.
Well, how many contributions in how many footnotes and how do you have a lot of different people, or do you have a sort of small core group of people that are making a lot of submissions?
Well, there's both. I mean, I would say about, it seems to me, and I've been going through, and I've been interested in this too, about half the footnotes so far seem to be contributed by a core group of maybe, you know, 15 to 20 sort of usernames that I recognize. And then the other half are people who have contributed maybe one footnote as sort of their kind of entry into the contest in the hopes of getting, you know, in the last thing, or just to experience what it's like to add a footnote. So I'll be interested to see if there are as many footnotes added to the later chapters as to the early ones, because a lot of the people who were just going to contribute one have already, you know, contributed there sometime in the first two or three chapters. I mean, I suppose other newcomers will start adding them to later chapters because their probability of being used would be higher. It's, if you're thinking of it in terms of, like, the contest. But I think the other reason why there's going to be less footnotes in later chapters is, you know, the beginning of the book is where you need to explain all of these concepts. You know, toward the end of the book, I'm using words that I've already used earlier on, so there's less of a need for that kind of footnote. What I'm seeing now in the discussion boards is people thinking up different sorts of footnotes to write, wondering if, you know, maybe now that we're almost halfway through the book, if the annotator should start commenting on the story itself, you know, on the values that are implicit, whether they should be questioning whether this book is fiction or nonfiction, did this happen or not. So I think there's other levels that they can get to now with footnotes rather than just, you know, explaining terminology, you know, making it more like a little bit more like biblical critique, you know, where you're, adding side stories, you know, saying, well, there's also a legend about this person or this company, so it could it can kind of take on a different sort of a life.
Yeah. It's interesting to me in a number of things that I've read just how many allusions there are to the practice within Judaism of commentary and debate upon scripture.
Right. Well, I mean, Judaism was really developed to be what we would call an open source religion. That's really the next book I'm writing is about that. It's called Nothing Sacred, The Case for Open Source Judaism. The idea was, I mean, and it's the basic Exodus story, is the way you break out of slavery is to really smash the idols that you believe in. You know, the plagues that everyone thinks were these sort of mean things that God did to the Egyptians, if you look at them in you know, allegorical context, the plagues represent the smashing of idols that Jews and Egyptians alike believed in. You know, the blood was really the desecration of the Nile, and the locusts were desecrating the corn, and the slaying of the goat was the slaying of Ares, who was the, you know, really biggest god at the time, the god of the New Year. So what you're looking at is a tradition that was based in being an iconoclast, really, and smashing idols and trying not to believe in anything. Or if you do believe in something, you believe in a god that's so abstract that it can't be named, it can't be uttered, it's just, you know, beyond human comprehension. And the tradition that developed around that was really of a bunch of people sitting around a table. Unfortunately, at the time it was men, but a bunch of people sitting around a table arguing. And the basic premise for these arguments was that, you know, you can talk, as Joan Rivers would say, you know, can we talk? It was that anybody could talk about anything. There was no truth so sacred that it could not be questioned. And I'm really an advocate of people being able to question the values that people are living in, to question the assumptions of their time in order to experience a bit more autonomy and a bit more participation in their own lives.
Mm. Just real quick, again, in this part of Focus 580, we're talking with Douglas Rushkoff. He's written a number of books dealing with new media, popular culture. His books include Siberia, Media Virus, Playing the Future, the novel Ecstasy Club, the book Coercion, Why We Listen to What They, quote-unquote, Say, and also this project we're talking about here, Exit Strategy, an online novel. It's being serialized on the Yahoo Internet Life's website, and he is inviting people to participate. In a sense, it's not truly open source because you can't go and change his basic story. But what you can do is go and participate in this sort of process of commenting on things that are in the story.
Well, it depends what you think the story is. In other words,
I see.
And the original open source movement Linus Torvalds, who developed this thing called Linux. I mean, there was a central kernel, you know, that really wasn't changed. Mm-hmm. And if it was, it was changed, you know, by really he decided what would be changed and what wouldn't. You know, when you look at fiction, I mean, you want to try to create an open source universe for fiction. It's very tricky. If you make, say, Star Trek open source, say, okay, from today on, it's an open source universe, some kid, you know, can kill Spock tomorrow, and then Spock can't be used by anybody again. He's gone. Or you have to bring him back to life and then kill him again. The problem with open source linear fiction is that you end up with the worst, the least common denominator. In other words, you end up with the worst of each person that's there rather than the best. Which is why I tried to develop an open source model for fiction that actually allows for the aggregate, you know, best of everyone who's participating. So this way, by sort of creating a central document, which is the first novel that I wrote, that becomes like the rules of the game. So it's open source and that people can contribute whatever they want, but they're building it around a rule set, you know, which is this world, this document. So it's like saying, let's play a game where we find this ball. No, the ball itself is not open source. You know, that basketball that they're playing with, but we can play with whatever, you know, we can play with it however we want to. So it's really my way of contributing something, throwing this in the mix and saying, okay, now let's play with this object. You know, the same way really that the Torah is open source and that anyone can write this stuff called Midrash. And that's really open to the public, you know, to create the stories and the commentary on what this thing means. So the writing that we're doing, Exit Strategy, really is an open source project that's built around a fixed document. Hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I see the distinction. Yeah. But you were talking a little bit earlier and more articulately than I about the sort of open source approach to talking about who we are and what our culture is and what we think is important. I know that some people would have said it at one point, well, the internet is going to be a very important tool to give people the opportunity to do that. And I think also some people are really, and you among them, I think, are concerned about exactly how this technology actually has ended up being used and has been seized upon by commercial forces as a way of selling stuff. What happened to that promise, you think, and is it still possible for people to take control of that once again?
Well, I think the most profoundly important thing about the internet was not its functionality, but the idea of the internet itself. You know, using the internet, especially in the early to mid 90s, changed the way people thought about the mainstream media. You know, you couldn't go on a website and see the way news is put together, see the way even video is put together, and you can't look at the evening news the same way. You start to realize how arbitrary it is, and that, you know, the corporate control over media, the very limited avenues for public television and public radio really do shape our cultural agenda. You know, just to be able to speak through the monitor instead of just sitting on the couch receiving through a monitor makes people realize that when they do sit and watch TV, they're doing so voluntarily. It's not the only way to use one of these TV screens. What happened was, really most simply, was, you know, big business in the mainstream media found out that families that had internet connections were watching, you know, something like 8 or 9 hours less television a week, you know. So they were becoming content rather than consuming content. And this is a problem for people who make their money by getting other people to consume content or by getting people to watch their commercials. So the sort of freewheeling quality of the internet, the web surfing, channel surfing tendencies of young people in particular really had to be curbed. So a number of campaigns were developed. You know, the first one was about this thing that they started calling the attention economy. They said, well, you know, real estate online is basically infinite, but eyeball hours, which is the amount of time that human beings can watch something on a screen, eyeball hours are limited. So they started to develop techniques to capture eyeballs. You know, they call it stickiness, which is basically how well a website can keep you stuck there. Now, and we started, unfortunately, I think, over-diagnosing our children with attention deficit disorder at the same time. You know, to me, things like attention deficit disorder are reactive strategies to a world where someone's trying to program them everywhere they look. You know, and rather than drugging them to pay better attention, we might start looking at the causes of why they feel so loath to pay attention. You know, what happens to them when they do pay attention to a television commercial or a movie or one of these more coercive dot-com sites. Then the other thing that happened was a lot of people who got involved in the internet and in interactive technology for one reason, basically, because it was fun, because it was liberating, because it was a way to communicate, a lot of them got seduced by the idea that this was going to be a way to make a whole lot of money. You know, the story about what the internet is was really changed by the mainstream media from this kind of wild, wild west hacker freedom of media zone to a business space. You know, the internet, the word internet and the words .com really became used as a public relations strategy for the NASDAQ stock exchange to try to, you know, get money into extremely specious business plans. So the new story of the internet was not this sort of people liberating new media literacy populist technology, but rather a really a way to orchestrate and administrate a fantasy global economy that really didn't exist. The internet's a great invention. You know, the toaster's a great invention. The telephone's a great invention, but it's not enough to on which to base an entire economic boom for the entire planet.
There was a point not very long ago when people were looking at the potential of the internet as a distribution system for books, essentially, and people started thinking about the idea that there might be online, a lot more online publishing, that there would be books that would be available that way, and you could print one if you wanted, but that essentially it was a way for writers to bypass the publishing world completely. Maybe you still have to, if you're not going to do it, distribute it yourself, you may have to have somebody kind of help you with that. But still, it was a new sort of model, and people were wondering, well, what's that going to really mean for publishing? And it doesn't seem, at least so far, that electronic books, that way of disseminating and publishing, has at least yet gone anywhere. Is that something you think that you still think is something that there's potential, and we just sort of have to figure out how to do it, or that's something of a dead end?
Oh, I think it's almost inevitable. I mean, I think what we're looking at now is, especially in stories like the Napster story, which is about, you know, people using a piece of software to distribute music and to get music, you know, without, paying the recording industry anything. I think what we're seeing really is the five media conglomerates that own 90-some-odd% of, you know, the media space right now, we are watching them fight to retain their roles as middlemen. But they're fighting a losing battle because the editorial that they create is more and more skewed towards the products that their conglomerates are making, and people are becoming more and more aware that, you know, that the mainstream media is just not is not going to distribute the goods and services, you know, that people really want, or the content that reflects the experiences that people are really having. Because if they start to distribute content that reflects our real experience, then they're going to be distributing content which is hurting one arm or another of the giant corporation. So I'm a little sanguine, I suppose, long term, because it looks to me that companies such as, you know, AOL, Time Warner are pretty much sowing the seeds of their own demise, that this mass conglomeration and monopolization of media leads to product that is so inane that more and more people will begin turning to things like, you know, public radio, or looking for things like public radio where they don't exist, in order to have an accurate experience. So as far as an author distributing his work, I'm going to use whatever means are at my disposal to do so, depending on, you know, what the work is and who's going to distribute it best. You know, right now there are still publishers who can get the word out about me writing a book through the established media channels, like, you know, New York Times book reviews and things like that, better than I can as an independent. But slowly and surely, you know, as we start to take more and more baby steps towards self-publishing and independent publishing, which is really what I would consider the exit strategy project to be, and as we see that the sky doesn't fall for us, we still stay alive and we end up actually communicating with more readers and doing so on really on more levels and in a more profound fashion, you know, people will find out, hey, you know, the water's safe, the waters are warm, and this is a more fun place to play.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Douglas Rushkoff. He's the author of a number of books dealing with new media and popular culture. He's done radio commentaries on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. He also has written for a lot of other publications, including Time and Esquire and GQ. He's professor of media culture at New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program. And by the way, if you'd like to read this project that we talked about at the beginning of the interview, Exit Strategy, and you can get on the Internet, you can go to Yahoo Internet Life's website, www.yil.com, and the first few chapters of Exit Strategy are there, and eventually it'll all be there. And then if you want, you can participate. You can play the game that we talked about by offering your own footnotes, and the idea is that eventually the best will be selected and there will be a print edition, maybe, I guess, early next year. That's what you're...
Yeah, there's a print edition that'll be available in a couple of weeks that includes the 200 or so footnotes that I wrote, and then in January it's going to include an additional 100 footnotes of the sort of user anthropologists.
Back in, I guess it must have been about 5 years ago, when Playing the Future was out, we talked about the book. And this was a book about when you were looking at the way, particularly that young people, like kids and teenagers, were looking at participating in thinking about these new digital technologies and suggesting that for older people, maybe we might take them as a model for the way that we might learn to live with these technologies as well. And I wonder how particularly if your thinking about that has changed, or if you somehow were going to write Playing the Future again, or maybe do an annotated and updated edition, would you think differently about some of that?
The only thing that pains me about Playing the Future is that marketers took the book much more seriously than parents did. So they ended up, you know, using a lot of the insights that I had about youth culture to develop, you know, sort of marketing schemes like the, you know, the Pokemon craze, you know, to create sort of products that that spread like viruses and that, you know, that depend on creating mythologies for kids that are in line with their, you know, their current cultural obsessions. But I think that the point that I was trying to make in Playing the Future still stands, that kids are natives to this media space and most adults are immigrants, and that if we want to understand how to best utilize it and cope with it, we should look at the behavior of our kids rather than trying to make our kids conform to our behaviors in you know, in older media spheres, in older, you know, cultural eras. And, you know, I think, if anything, we're learning the lesson all the clearer. You know, adults got obsessed with money and how do we capitalize on this thing while kids were out there playing. You know, well, the market crashed. The whole thing's gone. And what we're basically left with the Internet right now is a giant entertainment space and perhaps a news distribution space. You know, the whole effort of adult culture, of Madison Avenue and of Wall Street, to turn what was really a playground, a public park, a public utility, really, that allowed for communication on an unprecedented level, that the adult effort to turn that into a strip mall, you know, into an extension of the stock exchange failed miserably, as anyone who watched kids, anyone who understood what new media was about, could have told you from the very beginning. So if anything, I would write Playing the Future almost the same way, except put some more exclamation points and underlines in there, and maybe more explicitly point out the pitfalls of many of the kind of old world adult applied profit driven models, and show why they don't really work when you're talking about an organic cultural and social space like the internet.
I know it seems to be a little distressing to you and maybe a little ironic that the writing that you've done that's a critique of the market-driven marketing culture we have, where so much of what we're exposed to is an effort to get us to buy stuff, that has much more been picked up by people who are marketers, who are looking for insight and ways to actually do that very thing, than it has been what was the target audience, which seemed to be all of us as consumers, to think about just how that's what it is that people are trying to do to us. We haven't paid as much attention, but the marketers have, and you picked up on your books and used them and mined them for tips that they can use, and when they're trying to do this.
Yeah, I mean, they're even being used in courses about what's called capitology and influence and advertising. So it's a little ironic. On the other hand, what it made me realize, and this is part of why I wrote Coercion, is that we can't really sustain an arms race against marketers and advertisers. It's not a matter of us coming up with a defensive strategy, because then they come up with a new countermeasure. It's more a matter of learning how to disconnect completely, whether it's by taking a day off, called Sabbath, if you like, where you actually disconnect from the culture of buying and selling, or, really looking for ways to enhance your autonomy in any way possible, gain perspective, and then your responses to advertising, to media, and to market culture will be different because you have a set of values that are your own.
We do have about 5 minutes left, and we do have a caller here, so we'll bring them into the conversation. If somebody else wanted to call real quick, we could try to get him in, but we don't have very much time. Let's go here to our Chicago caller here, line number 4. Hello.
Thank you. I really enjoy your commentary on everything and the insider interpretation you have, and I also want to say that I'm sure that Marshall McLuhan or people like Buckminster Fuller would have been very happy with this conversation and the insights you and David are providing. And I want to thank you very much for your book and look forward to the exit strategy and all that in the future. Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks. And some people have compared you to Marshall McLuhan. I don't know how you feel about a comparison
sure,
like that.
Sure, what the heck. I'll take it. I mean, on some book, some reviewer had said, "Oh, the brilliant heir to Marshall McLuhan." I was like, "Oh, I'm an heir. Where's the money?" And Bucky Fuller, even better, as far as I'm concerned. He's, I'm really more from the tradition of thinkers like Bucky Fuller or even Timothy Leary and Alan Watts. People who are looking at the way we create value, the ways technology and science can be used to promote the great human experiment rather than co-opt or derail it. And I'm an advocate of somewhat strident optimism, especially when facing dark times. We have to at least be able to envision ways that we can find, both cultural and technological escape routes from what seems like, impending doom and calcification.
I'm just curious, did you have a particularly religious upbringing? Was that really important to you when you were a kid or in your family?
No, not really. I mean, I was raised as a suburban Jew, which meant going to temple, hearing about Israel and the importance of Zionism, the dangers of intermarriage, and preparing for a bar mitzvah. I mean, there was one kind of cool rabbi I remember who came through class when I was a little kid, maybe 9 or 10, going to Sunday school. And he said, "Oh, we can ask him any question we want." He was a new kind of radical rabbi. And I asked him, "Okay, what's God?" And, I was a precocious little kid. And eventually he came around to say, "Well, God is your conscience, finally. That's where you can locate him. He's in your conscience. When you do something and you feel that tug of conscience, that's God." So So he walked around the rest of the day telling all the kids, God is your conscience. He was all excited about that. And he got fired 2 weeks later, you know, because parents didn't want to hear a rabbi telling kids that God is their conscience. He's supposed to be this guy with a white beard up in the heavens somewhere.
So you're responsible for getting the rabbi fired.
I felt partly responsible for that, and I got turned off religion then for a good long time. So, no, I would say religion hasn't had a real part in it, but spirituality in some sense has. The notion that we're all connected, the notion that if there is no great purpose to the human experiment, we can actually devise one. You know, even if we're just fungus on a rock and there is no God, who's to say we can't, strive towards one or create one or be one? So I am trying to help people infuse their existence with meaning, whether we call it, you know, religion or not.
Somehow it reminds me of Woody Allen's joke about, I don't know if there is an afterlife, but just in case, I'm bringing a change of underwear.
Exactly. Keep your cover your back.
Keep your options open. Yeah, that's right. So now, and you did talk a little bit about how you are working on a project now, another book that pursues some of these angles. Is that indeed what it is now is occupying a lot of your time, besides continuing to monitor what comes in on Exit Strategy?
Started it last week. You know, got a new publisher who's interested in these kinds of ideas, and kind of been letting me kind of spread my wings and fly to regions other than the things that explicitly deal with media and new media. You know, I'm was interested in the new media story for how it reflected the kind of the extension and expansion of human potential. You know, for the allegory it served as a kind of human evolutionary agent. I'm not really interested in technology for technology's sake. I'm not interested in the AOL Time Warner merger, except for how it affects real people, you know, in real places. So I've got a publisher now who understands I'm really much more of a social philosopher and thinker than I am a media tech guru, and is letting me do, you know, work about Judaism and youth culture and other areas.
Well, I want to say thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We certainly appreciate it.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, and keep up the good work.
All right, we'll do our best. Our guest, Douglas Rushkoff, his books are out there, should be available in the library and the bookstore. And if you're interested in sampling some of Exit Strategy, the online novel, you might even want to participate. You can go to Yahoo Internet Life's website at www.yil.com, and several chapters are there. Eventually, it'll all be there. And that way, you can contribute your own footnotes. And of course, you can also eventually get an actual copy printed on paper if you want to read it that way.